Haitians living in Springfield face an uncertain future. A possible surge in immigration enforcement seems to be on hold, but for how long? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, how the state is helping the community prepare. Then, why some state lawmakers want to ban NIL deals for student athletes in middle and high school, plus efforts to rein in massive data center developments, and how Ohio communities plan to spend their share of marijuana tax revenue. Joining me now to get the news review started is Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, glad to be here.
Great to have you. So last week, Ohio was bracing for this surge of immigration enforcement activity in Springfield. Then came a federal judge's ruling this week. Tell us what happened.
Well, it really came at almost the 11th hour. The temporary protected status for Haitians across the country, including about 12,000 to 15,000 living in the Springfield area, was supposed to expire Tuesday at midnight. And then I believe it was Monday night that a federal judge, in a pretty strongly worded ruling, decided to extend the temporary protected status indefinitely. And so now, as of today, the Trump administration has said that they are appealing the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the story is still out there. But for right now, Haitians have their TPS extended indefinitely. And so there won't be a surge of ICE anytime soon. At least we think that's the case.
Yeah. What does Governor Mike DeWine say he's been told by the Department of Homeland Security about all this?
Well, it's interesting because his spokesperson, when I asked about any plans that he had heard about, his spokesperson said we had heard of no plans. Well, then DeWine himself actually called me and said there's a little bit of nuance here to understand that Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem had said her office had said to DeWine that there were no plans, no direct orders to go into Springfield. But he said that there were personnel on the ground in Springfield who said that they had gotten orders, but they didn't have a date. And so all of this was happening before even the ruling. So DeWine said he was getting mixed signals. He said it was unclear what exactly the plan was. But certainly for right now, we're in a wait and see period because the judge could rule. The Trump administration has asked the judge to suspend her ruling while they appeal. That seems unlikely, but we'll see what happens here. But certainly, the community, immigrants, and advocates for them in Springfield and also in Columbus, because we have a fair number of immigrants in Columbus, are just a little bit worried.
Sure. So, does the governor still see this as kind of a fluid situation in terms of what the federal government might do at any point?
Oh, absolutely. And he is in support of TPS for Haitians. He says that he thinks it would be bad policy to remove that. And for those people who are, Springfield businesses say, very important to the economy there, he thinks it would be a mistake for TPS status to be removed. He's not only concerned about the economy of Springfield, and also the people, their families would be broken up, but the kids who would be left behind, because he said in talking to the hospital in Springfield, there have been about 1,300 kids that have been born, and those kids are U.S. citizens. And so if their parents are deported, if there's an ICE surge, what happens to those kids? So he said that the state is working with Children's Services and charitable groups to try to figure out how to best help those kids if that's what ends up happening.
Hmm. Well, the surge of immigration enforcement in Minnesota and the fatal shooting of two American citizens there by federal agents has drawn lots of protests in that state, including a case where protesters disturbed a Sunday service. And I know that inspired some lawmakers in Ohio. Tell us how.
Well, and that's an interesting case because as of the last I checked, there were charges filed against several people, including two journalists, and those were dismissed. The argument has been, is it free speech to go into a church and protest? And the journalists said they were not doing anything of the kind. They were just being journalists and documenting what was happening. But, it's just one of the many things that people around the country don't want to see that's happened in Minnesota happen where they are. And so you've got two Republican lawmakers who want to enact some harsher penalties for people who do disrupt and disturb religious worship. This is Representatives Tex Fisher and Jonathan Newman, who are both pretty conservative. They would raise the penalty for interrupting a church service with a protest from a first degree misdemeanor to a fifth degree felony. And that would cover churches, synagogues, mosques, online religious gatherings, anything like that.
So it's already a crime in Ohio to disturb a religious worship service. What prompted lawmakers to make that a crime, to make that, you know, to put that into the law?
Well, I think just the attention that that story about the protesters, including and the journalists, including former CNN anchor Don Lemon, got, the attention that got nationwide, I think, you know, certainly there are a lot of people who are wondering about the free speech implications of that and the First Amendment protections that those folks should enjoy. But also, again, there are people who are watching what's been happening in Minnesota and very worried about it coming to their state and their community. And so this is a bill that these lawmakers say would give the state attorney general the ability to charge protesters if local prosecutors decline to do so. So that's another element of this that they feel like will help protect church services from disruption, which they fear might happen because we've seen it in Minnesota.
Where does this bill stand?
Well, it has yet to be scheduled for a first committee hearing, but it's been kind of a slow period here since the first of the year. I mean, we got big snowstorms and lawmakers have only been back for a day or two here and there. So there's nothing happening yet. But this is the kind of thing that as the election year politics cycle goes, this could be something that could get some attention. I think a lot of the things that you're going to see come through the state house are going to be things, because Republicans dominate the state house, that are going to echo what Republicans nationwide are saying.
Well, let's talk about another piece of legislation that some Republicans are backing. The Ohio High School Athletic Association recently approved name, image, and likeness deals for student athletes. Now there's pushback from some Republicans in the state house. Tell us about that.
Well, these are two Republican lawmakers, one of whom I had talked to right after the vote from the Ohio High School Athletic Association member schools allowing name, image, and likeness deals for high school students. This is Representative Adam Byrd, who said the day after this vote, I think is when I spoke to him, that he was very disturbed by this. He doesn't want to see NIL deals for high school athletes. So he and Representative Mike Odioso, who was a football coach for 16 years at St. Xavier, they got together and put this bill forward that would ban NIL deals, not only for high school kids, but also for middle school students, which it's kind of amazing that that could be a possibility, but they want to just guard against that. They say that the public dollars that have been invested in schools should go to kids to basically have an extension of the classroom in on the football field or on the track or wherever they're playing. It's not, that investment was not to help certain students earn an income because they just happen to be more talented than other kids.
Do they have any concerns about the impact on schools that this, that these NIL deals could have?
Well, I asked Representative Odioso about that. A lot of states, I mean, we've got like more than 40 states that have allowed NIL deals at high schools. And I said, well, you know, won't this, if this does go forward, put Ohio behind and make Ohio one of the handful that does not allow, so we could lose talented students? And he said, if that happens, he's not going to shed a tear because he wants high school athletics to be reserved for the neighborhood kid who's playing on the street, or the kid who wants to view high school sports as, again, an extension of the classroom and not as a way to earn an income. I mean, the argument has been made that high school students already have the ability to earn incomes. They can go get jobs in fast food and retail and wherever, but quite often athletes can't because of their schedules. And so this was seen by some as a way for athletes to continue their training, to do well for their school, and also to make a little income for themselves.
It seems like the high schools and even middle schools would have some work they would have to do to kind of monitor all this too. Are they worried that could be extra work for those schools?
Well, yeah, Byrd and Odioso both said that the compliance issues and making sure that schools are in compliance and that all their athletes are eligible, that they're following all the NIL rules, that's kind of an unfunded mandate on those schools. Now, remember, 79% of the Ohio High School Athletic Association member schools voted in November to approve of this, to allow for this change for NIL deals in high school. So that's a majority of the schools that voted. A lot of schools didn't vote. And that's one thing that Byrd and Odioso point out. They said that this whole situation was prompted by a lawsuit that a athlete from Dayton had filed trying to get an NIL deal. And they feel that they, these schools were backed into a corner here. So this legislation would stop that.
Huh. Has the Ohio High School Athletic Association made any comments about this legislation?
Well, I think the Ohio High School Athletic Association has, I mean, I think they see kind of both sides of this in a way, but of course they are backing up their member schools. They say that they're looking forward to the whole committee process and educating lawmakers about what NIL deals are like in high schools. And one of the things that was brought up, Odioso mentioned that the whole, as he put it, garbage with the transfer portal, he doesn't want that coming down to high schools. And the OHSAA said, that's not the way that things work for NIL deals and in high school athletics. College athletics and NIL deals in high school are totally different things. So this is going to be something I think we're going to hear a little bit more about.
So where does this bill stand and what's next with it?
Again, it was just introduced, and because we just really haven't had a whole lot of action by lawmakers in the last couple of weeks, this is still waiting for the go-ahead to move forward. But the idea that it's out there is worth discussing.
Well, another hot topic to talk to you about. It seems like every day there's a new dispute over these data centers. What are Ohio Democrats doing, or what move have they made regarding data centers this week?
Well, this is interesting because there is some bipartisan concern about data centers and not only where they're being located. There are some lawmakers who want to see them scattered throughout the state rather than in, like, for instance, we have got a lot in central Ohio, but also the concerns about the resources they use, the water that they use, the electricity that they use, and whether the use of those resources by data centers is driving up utility bills for customers. And so this is a bill, or this is several bills that the Senate Minority Caucus are drafting that would require community investment by data centers. And it would also restrict water use by those facilities and would really give the home rule power back to communities to make decisions about data centers rather than lawmakers or somebody else.
Do these data center projects get any tax breaks?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Tax breaks are very important. Lawmakers in the budget tried to end the sales tax exemption on the materials to build data centers, which was 100% sales tax exemption. So no sales tax on the materials to build data centers. DeWine vetoed that provision. And the Chamber of Commerce has defended that exemption and saying that that's what Ohio needs to have so there will be more investment in data centers. But there's some questions here. You've got some Republicans who have introduced a bill to create a data center study commission. There's bipartisan concern about the development of these, and not to mention the whole AI bubble and whether the investment in these things now could end up blowing up eventually if AI really is kind of a bubble here and not kind of the way things were in the dot-com back in the 90s with the economy.
I remember that well. So
yeah.
Where does all this stand? You mentioned the Ohio Democratic Caucus in the Senate is drafting some bills. There's this Republican strategy to create a task force. Do you have any idea what the time frame is for any of that?
I think I know that we've heard from lawmakers that they want to move forward some bills on data centers because it's a big topic of conversation. I mean, again, the utility bills that people are seeing, these skyrocketing utility bills and what role data centers actually are playing in terms of the load they're drawing. So I think that there might be some movement on data centers, but it really, unfortunately for Democrats, they really need to have Republicans on board to move any of their bills.
Well, I have been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Thanks for making time for us today, Karen.
Absolutely. Great to talk to you.
Up next, Mount Oreb residents have concerns about a mystery development in their community because they think it's a data center. This is Cincinnati Edition. The village of Mount Oreb in Brown County, Ohio, has fewer than 5,000 residents at last count, and a whole lot of them are concerned about a mystery development in their community that they think is a massive data center. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to explain all this is WCPO 9 news reporter Jay Shakur. Welcome back, Jay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you on the show. Jay, tell us about this mystery project in Mount Oreb. Do we know for sure it's a data center? Where is this?
We don't know for sure if it's a data center, actually. It's been described as a mega site. It is in Brown County, right off of US 32. It's again, a big piece of property, big piece of land right there in Mount Oreb, but no confirmation from officials because they signed NDAs that it is a data center.
Huh. So you said it's big. How big is it and how long has this been in the works?
It has been in the works for a few months now. At least it's gotten to the attention of residents for a few months now. It covers about 1,000 acres.
Wow.
And it is, again, been in the news, and residents have been adamantly going to council meetings, which, to my knowledge and from speaking to residents, is unusual to, you know, try to get answers about this project.
Well, you mentioned residents have been confronting village council members about the project at meeting after meeting. What are the concerns that they're raising?
Some of the concerns are the same concerns Karen was talking about earlier, you know, the use of, on energy, the use on water and utilities and things like that. I mean, the contribution that the developer will make to the community and the benefit that this will actually have. Residents still aren't seeing any of that. Council members still can't discuss any of that, or at least most of them can't discuss any of that because of the NDAs. So that's been the biggest concern there. You have some residents that are, you know, saying, hey, we want our, you know, our rural land. We don't want something industrial this close to our homes where we live and shop.
You've mentioned these non-disclosure agreements a couple times. What's the deal with that? Is this something like whoever's developing this wanted village council members to sign these so they couldn't talk about the project? Can you explain what's going on with those a little bit more?
Exactly. So it's a common practice, or it seems to be a common practice based on my reporting from in Mount Oreb and other places like Wilmington, where the developer, whoever that may be, has officials sign an NDA about the project. And to do that, to get more information about the project, they have to do that, is what council members in multiple municipalities have told us. And so they essentially can't discuss certain things about the project unless given essentially the green light from that developer. And most council members have signed it. In Mount Oreb in particular, all of the council members signed these NDAs, and then one village council member, Eric Lang, rescinded his NDA, which essentially cuts him off from any information, further information on this project.
So after rescinding that NDA, is he allowed to say anything about what he'd already learned, or does he still have to kind of keep his mouth shut?
From my understanding, he's kind of keeping what he knows close to the vest, keeping his mouth shut. But he did something interesting, which essentially is a tactic to get the developer, at the very least, to have more dialogue with the community that's concerned. He introduced a 180-day, six-month moratorium on data centers. So they're not officially confirming it's a data center, but they're just referring to it as a mega site. But he introduces a moratorium and said, hey, if this isn't a data center, then the developer shouldn't have an issue with this particular ordinance that we're passing. It went through its first reading early this week and has two more readings for final passage. But essentially, not saying much about what he knows, if he knows anything, but is saying, hey, we want to force, you know, more conversation about this in our community.
And you mentioned that he introduced this ordinance. Did the entire village council approve it?
They did approve it for the first reading. There were questions, you know, about the legality of it, you know, and we do this, and will we be sued if we do this, given that we've already began the process, i.e. signed NDAs and began the process of allowing this developer to buy the land, purchase the land, things like that. So there was conversation about that, but it did pass its first reading, has to go through two more readings for more public input, more public conversation. It's anybody's guess what that final vote on the third reading will be.
Huh. do we know anything about what the electricity needs of this mega site would be? You know, Karen mentioned that as a concern. That's certainly a big concern we've talked about with others on this show when it comes to data centers.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what, again, because there's very little information compared to other communities given publicly about this mega site. Again, we don't even know if it is a data center. But it's estimated based on certain requests that have been made in dialogue that has been made with the utility provider there that it could potentially require about 22,000 megawatts, 2,000 megawatts. So that's quite a lot of energy and power. But again, that's just, you know, some council members and the public putting together pieces of information and looking at pieces of information that have been discussed between the developer and potentially the utility provider there.
Huh. You mentioned that a lot of residents have been coming to meetings and speaking out. What are some of the other ways residents are speaking out about this?
Man, it's been something to see in a smaller municipality. Facebook has been galvanizing residents. They've connected through that, you know, the village doesn't have its own official Facebook or social media channels other than really YouTube. So they've created their own Facebook groups, particularly surrounding this with a few thousand people involved in these groups, collectively. They do come to meetings. They come packed in. I was there earlier this week and the room has a capacity of about 33 people. And it was packed, jam-packed with people outside of the meetings watching watching the live stream on a TV screen outside in the cold. They made it like a tailgate, essentially, to watch to see what officials were doing. So they have been, again, very active, very, very, very present. Last week, they had to use one of the school's gymnasiums for a question-answer session, which really wasn't many answers provided because of officials signing these NDAs. And they packed, you know, hundreds packed into that gymnasium.
Huh. You had said, you know, the residents are having to kind of find their own information, piece all this together without any confirmation that this is a data center. Is that what you've seen in other communities too? Is that a concern with these big developments, just the lack of information?
Yes, that's been the biggest concern. I guess you could say that's the thing that's most, you know, they have the share in common is residents feel they're not getting enough information. They find out about it once things have been signed by officials or, you know, it's brought up after it goes before the planning commission, which is really the first stage in terms of, you know, buying the land and zoning the land and everything like that. They found out about it after that when it gets to council, whatever municipality. And so that has been the biggest really concern, transparency. You know, what do we know? What is this? Some municipalities have more detail, like, you know, Wilmington, we know it's a data center. We can say authoritatively it's a data center, you know, at the very least funded by Amazon. We can't say that particularly here in Mount Orb, which is, to my knowledge, the only case recently in Central Ohio where we don't exactly know. By all, you know, markers, it is a data center, but we don't exactly know.
Sure. Are these residents that you've heard from, that you've talked to, are they against all development at this site, any development at this site, or is this specifically about, hey, if this is a data center, we don't want it?
It's a mixed bag. You have some residents that are outright, you know, we don't want this. We know, we hear about other states, other places where it's a strain on water and electricity. We don't want this. We don't want that issue. What would this, at the end of the day, what is going to do to my pocketbook? Is going to raise my utility bills? There are others like, you know, we just want more information. Maybe we want it. Maybe we don't. We just want more information. And they feel, particularly Mount Orb, hey, you haven't done your due diligence to get the necessary answers for us before we, you know, essentially give away so much land.
Have you heard anybody at any of these meetings speak in favor of a potential data center, saying, hey, if it's a data center, let's bring it?
Very few, maybe one or two in a crowd, in, you know, crowds vary, but in crowds of a couple hundred, very few have outright said, you know what, I want this. This is a great positive thing. It's typically either we need more information and we're upset about the lack of transparency, or we don't want it at all because we've seen or heard, or, you know, may have read other reporting in other cities and states about what it's doing.
So you mentioned that this ordinance that was introduced earlier this week, do you have any sense for when the ordinance will get a second and third reading?
It's not official, but it's based on the scheduling of Mount Orb's village council meetings. It potentially may be on the agenda on February 17th at their next village council meeting. Mount Orb, unfortunately, doesn't have everything up to date in terms of agendas and everything online, and officials haven't confirmed that. But that would be the next logical step, because one of the village attorneys says, hey, this potentially could be a good idea of passing this moratorium because it would force, or give us more time, I should say, to gather information and get more answers for residents. So it appears that council has the will to take it up as soon as possible, let it go through the process. It was one of the questions was, hey, why wasn't this introduced as an emergency ordinance, you know, to skip the three readings and just pass it? And it was brought up, the point was made, hey, we want to give it this, you know, its full process. So it's believed that it will be brought up at the next village council meeting towards the end of the month on February 17th.
It seems like there are a lot of these big data centers and projects like this being proposed for communities all over greater Cincinnati and Southwest Ohio, Northern, you know, in Kentucky. What are you and your colleagues at WCPO hearing from other communities about this?
We're hearing, you know, there are some projects that are inevitably going to happen in the works. There's a project in Northern Kentucky that broke ground just this week. So some of those concerns have either, you know, died down, or, you know, residents there have accepted the fate of what's going to happen. But particularly in Wilmington, there's still a strong fight to, if they can't stop it, at the very least get more benefits for the community, you know, invest in our roads, invest in our infrastructure, if you're going to be here, you know, things like that. Although, you know, you're going to provide jobs, do something that's going to benefit, you know, the community as a whole in terms of infrastructure. So it's again, in multiple places. And the big thing is, hey, accountability and transparency, or do something for our community. If you're going to come here and it's going to happen, because, you know, AI is the thing, and typically these data centers are used to power AI, give us meaningful investments, because you're getting tax breaks, because you're getting all these incentives, give us meaningful investments in our infrastructure.
Just this week, two of your colleagues at WCPO also reported on other data centers. Is it tough to keep up with all these developments that are happening all over the place?
It is. I think it seems like this week we've done a story about data centers every week, and it's in a different location. It can be tough. Adams County is thinking about, you know, using a demolished power plant and converting it to a data center that will provide potentially 700 jobs, which some have said, hey, that's a better, more creative, more efficient use of land and property to take abandoned power plants and convert them to be data centers. So it is quite widespread, and myself, two other colleagues covered at least three different data center projects this week alone, outside of what we've already covered within the last year, which has been at least about four or five within the last year.
Yeah. So what are you going to be watching for next with all this?
I'm going to be watching particularly if Wilmington follows potentially the model of Mount Orb in terms of officials saying, hey, let's do an official moratorium. They did pause passage of certain final approvals to get more information in Wilmington, but the idea of a moratorium was never brought up. So potentially other municipalities will watch and see what's happening with other areas and may get ideas to say, hey, this is a measure we could take to get more information for our community, whether it happens or not, or if it's inevitably going to happen. This is what we could do. So I'm watching to see, you know, I wouldn't say delay tactics, but tactics that officials may take in other areas to get more information and essentially bring the developer, whoever it may be. Amazon is a big name developer that's doing data centers and building data centers. But I'm watching for that. I'm also watching to see if, and so far it hasn't happened, if a data center outright fails, meaning it's the project is outright stopped. That hasn't happened yet at all, even given, you know, significant, seemingly overwhelmingly outcry against it. It hasn't happened at all in really any of these areas.
Well, I have been talking with WCPO9 news reporter Jay Shakur. Thank you so much for your time today, Jay.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Up next, Ohio communities are finally getting their share of marijuana tax revenue. This is Cincinnati Edition. Ohio communities are finally getting a share of the tax money the state's collected from marijuana dispensaries. At the same time, local school districts are looking for new ways to ask voters for financial help. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss the windfalls and the shortfalls are reporter for the Ohio Newsroom, Kendall Crawford, and WVXU education reporter, Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Kendall and Zach.
Hi, Lucy.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with you, Zach. We're going to, so we can end on a high note with Kendall. See what I did there. Zach, why are so many school districts struggling to balance their budgets?
Well, there is a number of reasons. A lot of it has to do with the way schools are funded in Ohio. So how it's set up right now is, you know, certain schools get a portion of state funding. Some get more, some get less. And that's based on a local school district's ability to raise local funds from property taxes and that kind of thing. So at the same time, there's also the Fair School Funding Plan in Ohio, which isn't being fully funded to the level that was initially promised years ago. So it's a mix of a reliance on local funding, but also school districts receiving less funding than they had anticipated. And that becomes an issue, especially when you need to pass a local levy, but you can't because you're failing at the ballot. So we're seeing more and more school districts kind of run into a situation where they either have a deficit or are forecasting a deficit down the road that they now need to address locally because the support is not coming from the state level.
So now some local districts want to try something different with voters. Tell us about these efforts to put income tax increases on the ballot.
Yeah, you know, folks in Ohio are pretty used to seeing property tax levies for their local school districts on the ballot. That's been the norm for a long time. This year and part of last year as well, that's starting to change. And what is becoming more popular now is income taxes, which there are two kinds, traditional and earned income taxes. And these are now starting to become kind of the more popular ways of raising local funds for school districts. And a lot of that has to do with some of the issues around property taxes. We heard a lot about that last year, rising property taxes being a growing issue for homeowners in the state. And there's been, you know, several efforts at the state house to kind of cap that and kind of slow the growth of property tax increases. And of course, a lot of people heard about an effort to abolish property taxes altogether. So it's been a major issue. It's been an issue with voters, especially. So school districts are trying to adapt to that now.
So what's the difference between a traditional income tax and an earned income tax?
Yeah, so a traditional income tax is a tax that is applied to all income earners. So that's people working jobs, and that's also people receiving retirement and disability benefits. They are included in that tax. An earned income tax is on earned income from a job. So that means people on retirement and disability aren't getting taxed. So what you're seeing there is basically certain groups kind of being excluded from that tax under an earned income tax. And because of that, more school districts are leaning towards that earned income tax, though some traditional taxes are going to be on the ballot in May as well.
Huh. So tell us about some of the specifics. What are these districts looking to do?
Yeah, taking a look, there are several now in Hamilton County that are going to be putting earned income or traditional taxes on the ballot. Mount Healthy Schools is one. They have tried to pass a property tax. This is going to be their fourth attempt. It's now going to be an earned income tax. So they failed with property taxes three times. They've been in a fiscal emergency since 2024. These local efforts have failed. So they're going with something different. They're going with a 0.75 earned income tax in May. That's going to raise around $3.3 million every single year for the school district. Also, North College Hill is now doing a 1.25% earned income tax. That's going to be on the May ballot. Also, Fairfield Schools is putting a 1.25 earned income tax. They tried to pass a property tax levy in 2024, and that failed. And then also, Franklin City Schools is doing a 1% continuing traditional income tax. They tried to do one last year, and that was a continuing income tax. They're now putting a 10-year cap on that income tax. So we're used to seeing kind of things flipped a little bit, more property taxes and fewer income taxes. Now it's completely the opposite, more income taxes on the ballot.
What makes these school districts think they'll have a better shot with an income tax of some sort on the ballot instead of a property tax?
It's got everything to do with who is going to show up on election day. So May 5th, we're looking at a primary election. And when you think about who shows up to a primary election consistently every year, no matter what, you can kind of count on those older retired populations to show up and vote. So when you have a situation where there is a, say, a retired homeowner in the community, when they're looking at a property tax on the ballot, they know that is going to affect them and cost them money. But if they see an earned income tax, they now know that their earnings are going to be excluded from that. So they're more likely to vote yes on an earned income tax than on a property tax. And that's kind of the strategy we're seeing from these school districts, is who's going to show up, who's going to vote, and what is the likelihood of getting this levy passed.
So what if voters don't pass these proposals? What will that mean for these districts? Have they said whether they'd have to make cuts?
Yeah, it depends on the district. Now, I know Fairfield has talked about reducing staff. Of course, Mount Healthy is in a fiscal emergency. It's really a dire situation in that school district. They would have to let go of more staff. And certainly, if this one doesn't pass in May, and if they fail to pass something in November of this year, that will likely mean cutting things like arts and sports, which would be pretty catastrophic for that school district as far as student life and getting kids to come to school. So what we're really seeing kind of across the board is this is going to affect a lot of staffing at local public schools, because for most schools, that is the biggest expense, is paying teachers, paying educators, paying staff. That payroll is a huge part of it. So if these measures aren't successful, that's where you're going to see most of the cuts happening.
Okay, well, we've heard about these shortfalls. Let's talk with Kendall about the windfalls. What about this tax money flowing into communities? It sounds like they're finally getting this tax revenue. Why did it take so long? How much are they getting?
Yeah, it took quite a while. As you know, Issue 2 was passed in 2023, and then a year later, we saw dispensaries start to set up in 2024. So it's been more than a year where communities were waiting, because with the ballot initiative, they were promised of the 10% tax that is on marijuana sales, that around a third of that would go to communities that decide to host dispensaries. So a lot of communities got a little frustrated waiting. Columbus even sent an invoice to try to get their money. And it was all just tied up in the legislature. The legislature was basically deciding how much they wanted to keep from the ballot initiative and how much they wanted to change. So they thought about eliminating the community host fund entirely. They thought about reducing it to 20%. In the end, they decide, okay, we'll stick with the original 36% number. And then they signed Senate Bill 56 into law. And so that finally released the money and the checks started rolling in.
How much are they getting? I mean, how much does this end up being for these municipalities?
Yeah, in total, it ends up being almost $36 million for about 100 different communities that decided to host dispensaries.
Huh? Who got the most?
Columbus wins that race. So they have around 20 dispensaries and they got over $4 million. But Cincinnati was in second place and they got $2.5 million just about from this tax revenue. And I will say, I mean, when you look at third, it's kind of surprising. It's in Hamilton County. It's Columbia Township. And they got nearly $1.6 million, which is a pretty impressive amount for a township of its size. It has a population of just over 4,000.
4,000 people?
4,000 people, yeah. Yes. And yeah, it's interesting to me because when you zoom out of the top 10 municipalities that got the most, around half of them are in Southwest Ohio.
Huh. Did you see any patterns based on location? I mean, did it really matter where these places were, where these dispensaries were, and who was getting the money?
Yeah, I think it mattered a lot because you would expect, you know, the top three to just be like Columbus, Cincinnati, Cleveland, all the major metros, just because, I mean, obviously they have more people, but also they have a reputation of being more welcoming to dispensaries. But that wasn't necessarily the case. There were small communities that got a lot of money. Columbia Township, like I mentioned, there was Wintersville, which is a small village in the Steubenville Metro in Jefferson County. They got $900,000, and that's $100,000 more than Cleveland got.
Wow.
And so I talked with researchers about this, and they said it basically comes down to location for places like Wintersville. Wintersville is very near the border with West Virginia in eastern Ohio. So they get people crossing the border, supposedly, to buy marijuana. And then when you look at places like Toledo and Northwest Ohio, they aren't doing as successful. They got like around $160,000. And so in Northwest Ohio, they have a lot of competition because Michigan also has legalized marijuana and they actually have lower costs than Ohio. So they might see the opposite of people leaving to go to Michigan to buy.
Yeah. Another reason to blame Michigan for something, right?
Yeah, if you needed one.
That's right. So what do you know about how these communities might use this money?
Yeah, so I spoke with a couple across the state. I spoke with Missy Mick. She's the mayor of Seven Mile in Butler County. And she said that their small village hasn't officially decided what they're going to do, but they have like a long list of things that they want to accomplish that they hope the money might go towards. So they're thinking about replacing an old dump truck. They might repave a street. They talked about a ballpark fence that needs repairs. And these are all things that they've really wanted to do for a long time, but because they have a limited tax base, just hasn't been in the budget. And then on the other end, you see some communities like Painesville Township, which is in northern Ohio. They are talking about using the money to try to curb the amount of times they have to go and put a levy on the ballot. So they are investing in their fire services expressly with the idea that they won't need to put that on the ballot next election. And those two communities, they pretty much line up with what a study from OSU found, which surveyed municipalities of these host communities. And it said that public safety was the number one priority, and then also infrastructure.
Interesting. Now, I know there are lots of communities in Ohio that have banned dispensaries within their borders. Do you have any sense whether seeing all this tax money flow to some of their neighbors might change any hearts and minds?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something that researchers say they're going to be watching as a definite possibility. Because if you take Seven Mile, for example, the mayor there, she talked about how when they first were deciding whether or not to host a dispensary, there was a lot of debate in the community. And she was actually on the side of like, she didn't think it was a good fit for them. But she said getting the paycheck actually was like validation of their choice. She said she hasn't had a problem and that it's going to make a huge difference for them. So I imagine, you know, if you're in a neighboring community, you have this moratorium, maybe it's expiring soon. You're seeing people start to cash these checks. It might at least warrant a conversation of like whether or not they want to continue banning them from coming in or maybe reconsider.
Do you know, so how much are the companies that profit from these dispensaries, how much are they making from all this versus how much the state of Ohio and these communities are getting? I guess, is there any way for us to know who's doing the best out of all this.
Yeah, well, if you look at total marijuana sales, recreational marijuana sales in Ohio, they've been at just above $1 billion as of December of 2025. And so that's the dispensaries themselves, what they have made. And then, you know, you take out that 10% excise tax that the ballot initiative put on. And so that's around $100 million that goes towards Ohio. And then again, you take a third of that for the municipalities, which is around 36. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a funnel system of course, these companies that are selling the product are making the most profits. But then you see that, you know, go towards the state and then finally down and towards the municipalities.
Sure. Well, and state lawmakers did make some changes about where some of that tax money goes, right? What would that 36% still goes to the community, but there were some other places that money was supposed to go that's not going there anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So while the community host fund stayed intact, they took out another fund that was supposed to be created, which was called the Social Equity and Jobs Fund. And so that was included in issue two. It was in the ballot measure. And it basically said that about another third of the tax should go toward initiatives like record sealing for people who may have been convicted of marijuana possession, or towards, you know, business owners with a record that might want to set up a job and helping them. That fund was eliminated entirely. So all of that money is just going to the state general fund now. And so there's no way of knowing really if that is going to be used for stuff like record sealing. And so that's another thing that researchers are trying to watch, is to see whether maybe local municipalities might try to fill that gap with their funds. The survey that came out last year, though, didn't show a lot of interest in that. It wasn't on a lot of municipalities' radars, but it is something that we're not seeing that was originally on the ballot.
Interesting. Well, I have been talking with reporter for the Ohio Newsroom, Kendall Crawford, and WVXU education reporter, Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time today and for these fascinating discussions.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. And if you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a nice weekend and stay warm out there.